Evidence Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour on this March the 5th on the West Coast, now March the 6th on the East Coast, and in the Central Time Zones. We'd like to welcome all those listening around the world on Wind Talkers Radio Network and on BlogTalkRadio.com on the Internet. Before we bring on tonight's guest, just want to mention that tomorrow, Eastern Time from 5 to 7 p.m., I will be a two-hour guest on Michael Herzog's The American Awakening, which is a show he used to have on RBN. It's now on Oracle Broadcasting, and I'm sure you'll find that very interesting. I'm going to be sharing some of my more recent research in regards to the, what do we call them? The infiltrators that we've had for presidents, going back to the 1950s, in fact. Of course, we'll be talking about Dwight David Eisenhower, and I will be identifying him by his real name, the name that, not the name that he used when he came to America, and he was not born in America. We're going to be revealing some new information that's coming out in the new article that I've been promising everyone is coming out, and that will be coming out very soon also. That one is called Teenage Mutant Ninja Birth Certificates. It's the sequel to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Eisenhowers. So I've gotten to the bottom of the birth certificate issue and actually am going to present some documentation that's quite damning to show that there was a real conspiracy. And you'll not be surprised when you hear some of the names who was involved in some shenanigans for a number of years with the individual that spearheaded this creation of a false document using people all over the country, people who were primarily not even Americans, I might add. Now, there's a lot of interesting information coming out. From England, we hear that that spy chips have been hidden in the what they call dustbins there, of course, are what we call garbage cans in the United States. And 2.5 million of these garbage cans in England have spy chips in them. Now, what do you think they would want to spy on someone's garbage for? I imagine that if we really stretch our imaginations, they're using them in toilets, too. So beware. If you see a pair of eyes looking up at you while you're sitting on the throne, I think it's time to run. With that, I'm going to segue to tonight's guest. With everything that's going on, the use of all kinds of weather warfare, and we can say that with a certain amount of certainty that they are using weather warfare. It's been admitted. It's been written about, it's been researched, it's been revealed by a number of whistleblowers as well as people who have figured out what's going on around the world. We've been experiencing a rash of earthquakes, which is basically the same technology being tuned to some different frequencies. The chemtrailing of our skies, depleted uranium. There is so much pollution in this corner of the universe that we're probably putting the rest of the universe at some major threat. And not to stop there, they have intentions of reproducing or getting to some level of awareness, scientifically proving or demonstrating the what they're calling the Big Bang. Now, I don't subscribe to that theory. That is theory. And we could say that's the true conspiracy theory there, is to try to brainwash us using terms that don't even make any sense. But we're going to continue a discussion that we've had in some past weeks with tonight's guest. He is a scientist and an inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher. He's our resident science advisor and my co-host on Fridays on Evident Footprints, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Gee, thank you, Don. That was a wonderful introduction. How are you doing this evening?
Well, I'm doing great. I'm anxious to hear what you have to say. We're going to be talking about this Hadron Collider, this super collider, this monstrosity of what sounds like it's going to be a real nightmare if this thing goes haywire. And Lord knows how they intend to use it, but I want to leave all that up to you. So I'm doing fine. Ask me at the end of the show.
All right. I'll take that as a cue to begin.
Okay, please do.
Well, I thought that the best way to get started with this whole subject of these super colliders is to turn back the clock a little bit and take a look at the work that was done by real serious investigators in the field early on, so that people have an understanding of where all this came from and what it's leading towards. Now, we have to remember that back in the 1920s and earlier, physicists were working to understand the basic laws of matter and understand how energy and mass interacted and all these things that we hear about, but they were basically doing it with no particular tools. I mean, biologists have microscopes so that they can look at their work and see life forms, you know, that are responsible for disease and for other effects in the body. And astronomers have telescopes that allow them to study the movements of the stars and the planets. But physicists didn't really have much of anything with which to explore the atom. Now, believe it or not, one of the first people that came up with a way of doing this was our dear old friend Nikola Tesla. And Tesla, of course, was a master at producing high voltages. And so he used these huge voltage gradients that he created to allow him to accelerate particles against various targets and then study the effects. Now, he was more interested in producing gross effects like light, for instance, and the transmission of power and things of that sort. But because of his work with high voltages, he opened the door to a whole breed of individuals that essentially started designing and building what came to be known as atom smashers. And atom smashers, or otherwise known as particle accelerators, believe it or not, is the subject that turned me on as a young man. That's what I wanted to do with my life, was to design and build particle accelerators and study the basic building blocks of nature. But anyway, getting back to my theme here, some of the earlier physicists who are well known in the annals of achievement in physics were people like I already mentioned Tesla, and then there's John Cockcroft, who was a British physicist, and back in the 1930s, he started to apply high voltage transformers to the concept of particle accelerators. And he teamed up with a fellow by the name of Walton, and between the two of them, they produced the world's first cascade rectifier system that was used for building up these enormous voltages to accelerate particles. And his device was known as the Cockcroft-Walton accelerator, and essentially, it was a big stack of capacitors and diodes that were wired in such a way to interact, and each stage of it boosted the voltage many, many times. And so finally they were playing around with potentials in the neighborhood of 800 kilovolts, which in those days was a very momentous achievement. And what they did with this voltage, of course, was they used it to they used it to bias a long accelerator tube about 8 or 10 feet long. And by 1932, they were actually disintegrating lithium targets and releasing protons from the nucleus and alpha particles and things of that sort, which they then could detect with various pieces of equipment. And another early pioneer that was very well known in this field was a fellow by the name of Robert Van de Graaff. Probably science enthusiasts have heard the term Van de Graaff generator, and that was the brainchild of this individual. Essentially what it is a large supported terminal of great curvature, and it's supported on a an insulating column, and an endless belt, usually made of, some of them were actually made of silk, but more traditionally they're made of rubber, and they literally carry electrons either to the sphere or away from the sphere using an electronic spray, a high-voltage spray system, and thereby build up an enormous charge across the elevated terminal. And in 1931, Van de Graaff built a double-sphered terminal arrangement in which he had the belts charged in opposite directions and carrying charge up to one terminal and down away from the other terminal, thereby doubling the potential. And by this system, he was able to produce about 750 kilowatts with the equipment, and he allowed this to discharge through an evacuated tube that joined the two systems together, and gave an overall potential of 1.5 megavolts, which in those days was a considerable achievement. And this was used to accelerate electrons and protons and even some heavy ions. And again, the purpose of doing this was so that these microscopic or subatomic particles could be used as, you might say, unseen little bullets that could travel with great momentum and tear into the nucleus of atoms, and in breaking them up, send out their components, which could then be investigated further and give people some insight into how the material was put together. Now, there was a limit, of course, and there always will be, as to how much voltage could be applied by means of a direct potential to any kind of a device, whether it be a Van de Graaff sphere or a Tesla coil. It doesn't make any difference. You can only support so much voltage, and then you start running into breakdown problems and problems with atmospheric conduction and moisture and all this stuff. So one of the earlier physicists by the name of E.G. Lawrence, came up with the brilliant idea. Instead of using one enormous voltage, he suggested using a series of smaller voltages and allowing the particles in question to be further accelerated by means of exposing them to repetitive potentials of lower gradient. And this this concept became known as a linear accelerator, and it was very successful. The the energies that were produced by this system were well into the millions of electron volts, depending on which accelerator, of course, you want to look at. And eventually, the concept caught on, and they were using these things for not only particle accelerators, but to accelerate electrons for the production of industrial X-rays and all sorts of other things. But there again, when we run into the same problem, how long can you really make one of these accelerators, and how much energy can you possibly transfer into a beam of particles before it becomes a ridiculous undertaking? The longer you make it, the more energy you get out of your beam, but the expense goes up exponentially. The maintenance for sustaining the vacuum and all the associated equipment for confining the beam just becomes prohibitively expensive after you get beyond 30 or 40 feet. It's just not worth doing anymore. So Lawrence was pondering this limitation, and he came up with a very interesting idea. Why not use only two electrodes instead of all these 50 or 60 or so that he had originally arranged in a straight line, and just force the particle to fly in a circle by using a magnetic field to steer it? And so that's the basic concept that gave birth to the idea of the cyclotron. And the cyclotron uses two D-shaped electrodes, which in fact are called D's, and they are hollow electrostatic electrodes that are in a vacuum, and a bunch of particles from an ion source are introduced at the very center of the circle, and then they're sucked into the D's, which are powered by very high AC voltages, which oscillate at a frequency which corresponds to the it's automatically changed as the particles go into a circular orbit. The frequency is changed to accommodate the fact that they cross the same electrostatic potential over and over and over again. So anyway, there we finally have the birth of the rotary accelerator, or the circular accelerator, which was known as the cyclotron. And the fundamental work that he did in his lifetime perfecting that machine led the way to accelerators of even higher energies, and that led to whole different species of accelerators, all of which were based on circular orbits. So you had machines called the Betatron, the Synchrotron, the Cosmotron, the Bevatron, and finally we wind up with the concept of a collider. And a collider is basically an accelerator that's designed in such a way that two particle beams are spun in a circle within the gigantic vacuum chamber, and they're literally spinning in opposite directions. So this is like having an automobile on the highway that's doing 60 miles an hour and another car coming in the other direction also doing 60 miles an hour. If they happen to hit each other, then the relative speed, the relativistic speed, is 120 miles an hour. And so that was the basic idea of the Cosmotron. By using Lawrence's principle, in two directions, you could at least double and possibly quadruple the amount of power that's being instilled in these particle beams. And then, of course, once you have the particles up to speed, instead of putting targets inside the tubes, which is what they used to do in the early days, now the new goal is to allow the beams to collide with each other. So they basically keep them separated until they're up to the highest possible potential, and then they steer them into each other with the magnetic field, And, of course, the particles destroy each other, and in the process create antimatter, black holes, and all kinds of subatomic residue, which these guys like to look at. And so finally, after having achieved collider status, we now come to, as you might expect, the super collider, which is not only using the same principle, but is now a machine that is so exorbitantly huge and generating so much power and consuming so much power, I might add, that it almost borders on being totally ludicrous. We're talking about accelerators now which are capable of developing energies, kinetic energies in their particles that are up to 100 trillion electron volts. Not billion, trillion. That's an ungodly amount of power, and it corresponds to many millions of ordinary watts. I mean, they're rated in the megawatts in terms of their beams, their beam capacity. And some of these machines are so huge that it's almost beyond comprehension. Now, Don, you were talking here last week about the huge collider that's hopefully they want to put it online sometime this year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in Switzerland, isn't it?
Yes, just outside of Geneva, on the border of France and Switzerland.
Well, they have in that particular device the entire orbit has a circumference of I think it was 17 miles.
I think it's 17 kilometers, if I remember.
Oh, okay, kilometers. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the tube itself is 12 feet in diameter, and this is equivalent to having, and it's housed in an underground tunnel, by the way, which is all cement lined and has focusing magnets all along its entire route. And this is equivalent to having a machine that would be roughly the size of the Washington Beltway, you know, in terms of its overall dimensions. And we're talking about a device that can produce, in that case, 40 trillion electron volts in each beam. Now, an electron volt is the amount of energy imparted to a charged particle when it falls through a potential of 1 volt. So just imagine 40 trillion electron volts is the equivalent of that same particle falling through a potential of 40 trillion volts. Trillion! I mean, that's an ungodly number. And the beam is going to have so much energy in it that it's actually measured in milliamps. And when you multiply the voltage times the beam current, you come up with, I forget the number, but it's at least a couple of hundred megawatts. So you're talking about potential energies that are almost beyond comprehension. There are going to be more than 2,500 scientists and technicians on staff to operate the machine, and the annual cost in maintenance and electrical power consumption is over $500 million, and that's just to maintain it. The cost to build it is somewhere around $12 billion or $18 billion. So you might say, well, okay, why would anybody in their right mind want to build something so magnanimous? You know, what is the ultimate goal here?
Well, the answer to that is they're not in their right mind. First of all, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, you know, some of the physicists that are involved in some of these things have some interesting ideas, okay? But in my opinion, nothing really magnanimous is going to come out of this unless it happens to be of a negative nature.
Mm-hmm.
This Hadron Collider was essentially designed to help them finally crack the remaining, I don't know what you want to call it, physical code of the building blocks of matter. And this idea that if you smash atoms finely enough, you have to eventually get down to something that is the absolute rudimentary building block of the whole universe. And I don't necessarily agree with that, by the way, but that happens to be the prevailing wisdom. And they have actually called one of these particles that they believe will have that property of not being able to be subdivided any further. And don't forget, we're talking about stuff that's way, way smaller than the individual particles that make up atoms. We've all heard about electrons, protons, and neutrons.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about stuff that's so small. I mean, I haven't kept up with it. They've got so many elementary particles now that they have to actually look them up in books, you know, because there's just hundreds of them. But the one that they're looking for, believe it or not, they've dubbed the God particle. It's supposedly no longer capable of subdivision, and it's going to have all these remarkable properties, and it's going to allow them to explain, you know, the presence of so-called dark matter in the universe, and, you know, why matter builds up the way it does in the different elements, and all these wonderful concepts.
Yeah.
But here's an interesting thought. These particle accelerators are also capable of being weaponized. They may not come out and say that, but knowing the history of our planet and the mindset of some of these people, it wouldn't surprise me at all if beams like that could be developed and then deflected out of a separate vacuum chamber onto an aiming mirror, and then be used to impinge upon a target. And the other thing that they have already done with these things, they've used accelerators of different types, particularly electron accelerators, to create what they call the free electron laser. And the free electron laser is essentially a laser that's powered by a particle accelerator. And they do this by oscillating the beam and forcing it to go around tight bends. And every time it does that, it produces pulses of radiation, which are emitted by the electrons in the beam as it's forced to change direction. And they can get various wavelengths out of this depending on the severity of the bends in the beam and the strength of the magnetic fields and all these other things. So these things can actually be tuned to any wavelength and produce radiations of various frequencies. And the energy levels that they possess are, of course, very significant. Now, nobody's going to tell me that that's going to be done for medical or industrial purposes, because energy levels that high would cook you in a matter of minutes.
It's obvious that it's a weapon system. There's no doubt about it.
Well, that's my summation, you know, as far as the ultimate goal. Sure, I think that they're probably interested in tinkering around with the building blocks of the universe, because that way they can imitate God. And the mere fact that they would call this Higgs particle the God particle, to give you some idea of where their thinking is on this subject. But the one thing we didn't touch, which I think we should now focus on, having laid this foundation, and that is the possible negative ramifications of doing this.
Mm-hmm. Before you do that, if I could just make a comment.
Of course. I mean, I'm finished with the intro anyway.
Okay. Just to respond to what you said. Okay. Now, the pretext for all of this is to understand the inception of creation, as I understand it. In other words, they're looking at the moment that caused the Big Bang. They're calling this a God particle, but there's no accounting for the intelligence of the Creator. I see no intelligence. This is a crapshoot, as far as I'm concerned. You know, this is like some new firework that somebody wants to try on the 4th of July. They have no idea what the spread of the explosive power and the unseen percussion that could result in not just causing deafness, but blowing people's eyeballs and eardrums out of their head. You know, I'm being a bit gross in my description, or my analogy, you're describing something that the rest of the universe is going to shudder over, not out of fear, but certainly concern that somebody could be so insane, so driven to gamble and risk everything else that's in existence. For what purpose? So they find out. They find this out. Like you said, ultimately, the most they can do is imitate God. You know, this is insane. This is absolute insanity. This is every horror picture, every monster movie, every crime movie, an organized crime movie. About the mob and every dictator that ever roamed the planet and every demon that ever roamed the planet, all rolled into one topic. You know, it's amazing. And I just wanted to vent and say that, you know, and certainly I'm likely going to agree with what you have to say about the ramifications of this. What could go wrong? What could actually happen? So I hope I haven't stepped on your toes in saying what I did.
No, it's okay. I wear steel-tipped shoes.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's actually anything that can withstand what you're about to describe, you know, anywhere.
Well, first of all, we're lucky in one respect, okay? The biggest problem that they have in this thing is actually the machine's capability of thermally polluting itself. By that I mean that it's very, very difficult to keep the temperatures in the cryogenic range and to keep the beam density very high as these types of velocities are reached. And, you know, there's all sorts of cooling, ingenious cooling systems that have been used, because even though they're traveling in a vacuum, you can't ensure that every particle that gets accelerated stays in the beam.
That's what
and
I mean.
And as these things race around millions and millions of times, they heat up their container. And so energy is lost in that respect. But enough of it is concentrated in the two beams that when they are unleashed upon one another, you're certainly going to get some hellish effects. Now, we know that from astrophysics that black holes occur under certain conditions in the center of various nebula and in the middle of different galaxies, and from the observations that we're capable of making so many light years away, it almost appears. And I kind of have a gut feeling about this. I mean, black holes are a reality, what their real function is may not be known, but I kind of look at them as the celestial analogy of water going down the drain. So like when you pull the plug in your bathtub, all the water just doesn't just surge down the drain. The whole bathtub doesn't feel the effect until you get in the vicinity of the actual drain, and that's where the whirlpool is. Well, the black hole is kind of the same thing. In my opinion, that what's happening there is the matter that is in that region is being recycled. And I don't know where it goes or exactly what happens to it. One theory is that it explodes out the ends of the nebula and in the form of pulsars and, these powerful sources of radio frequency emissions that we detect in the universe. But anyway, it's like the end of that particular piece of matter or whatever happens to go in there. And somehow I think it gets recirculated and comes back out somewhere else as a star. And we have this constant balance between what's being destroyed and what's being continuously created. Now, I came across an article while I was doing this research that actually says that concept was thrown out a long time ago because continuous creation doesn't have to supply an answer to the origins of the universe. Well, pardon me, what makes us think we're supposed to know? But anyway, that seems to be one of the reasons why it was discarded, was because a universe that's in constant creation and on one side and constant destruction elsewhere essentially maintains a constant in its presence, and that could go on for an infinity. So they don't want that because it doesn't fall into the human mystique of experiencing everything from a beginning to an end. And so the Big Bang Theory apparently is more appealing because it allows them to have a starting time for the clock instead of having an infinitely old universe. Well, the problem with the Big Bang Theory, in my opinion, Don, it doesn't prove anything. Because the first question I would ask as a rational being is, okay, we start the clock at time zero, something blew up. And it was this huge explosion that started the whole universe into motion. It's the beginning of all entropy. It's the beginning of everything. Where did that thing come from, whatever it was that blew up? You know, it doesn't answer any questions, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they want to investigate it, and they want to try and do it in miniature. And so one of the purposes of this collider system is to force these incredibly potent beams to impinge upon each other with such force that the temperatures, in the instantaneous temperatures in this collision impulse, simulate situations that they hypothesized existed at the Big Bang in the beginning of the universe. And I guess they experienced two separate outcomes from this. One, of course, is a possible formation of antimatter and black holes, which I'm sure they would love to get, to achieve in miniature. But the other thing that they keep talking about is that under these conditions of such enormous energies being confined in such incredibly small areas, the energy density is become so high that all the known laws of physics do not hold. So, I mean, let's assume that's true. Let's assume that when these beams hit each other, you're going to create a region where the known laws of physics are invalid. Well, wouldn't that in its own right caution you that maybe this isn't a good idea? I mean, if that's true, then how do you know?
Jim, are you still with us? Appears we lost Jim. Seth, if you're listening, it appears we lost Jim Murray. So we're going to try to reestablish contact.
No, I didn't. Oh. Where did I lose you, Don?
Oh, yeah, you just disappeared totally. I didn't hear a word you said after you made the comment that that the physics is totally different. So, or maybe be very unpredictable.
Well, you see, what happened there was we momentarily entered that zone. And radio transmission stopped.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was my thought. That was my thought on the subject. If they really don't know, you know, what to expect if they reach that condition, why would you risk doing it?
Yes. It seems to me several times over the past 20 years or so, the U.S. postal system was feeding the public this line that raising the price of a postage stamp would ensure not only that we'd get our mail, but we'd get it in a timely manner. And nothing has been further from the truth. In fact, they haven't been able to operate without going into debt, let alone just maintaining the status quo and operating like any other business. Now, I use that as an example because people can relate to that. Using a particle accelerator to turn time backwards to arrive at the inception of the creation, to me, is implying that God or the creator, however you want to refer to the master of the universe and all the multiverses, created the universe with a particle decelerator. Is that what they're saying?
I don't know what they're saying.
are you understanding the statement that I just made?
Of course.
If they have to reach that method by accelerating particles, which, I mean, I'd like to see where the particle decelerator that God used is located.
Well, the interesting thing is that by following the analogy you just laid out, the created universe is the decelerator, because from that instant of this magnanimous blast that everybody believes in these spheres, everything has been racing away from a common center, slowing down, cooling off, and ultimately, the universe faces thermodynamic death. So you see, at the one side, we have the Big Bang, where something hot and super condensed exploded, and it created the entire universe in one big grand hurrah. And at the other end of the spectrum, everything collapses back into, you know, a thermodynamic death, where there's no energy left, there's no time, there's no light, there's no nothing. Now, to me, you know, that just doesn't feel right.
Sounds like a vacuum cleaner. You know, what you're describing. You know, good old shop vac.
of rather large proportions.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is it has been hypothesized that long-term ramifications of this process are that once all of the matter in the universe reaches whatever state it has to go to have zero energy, it'll still have gravitational properties. And then everything will start to accelerate backwards the other way, and in another couple of billion years, it will all arrive at its starting point and compress into a singularity, which will explode all over again. Now, if there are still physicists who buy that story, then what's the big deal? You're right back to continuous creation, except that it's got a slightly different spin to it. So, you know, if that process goes on forever, there's really no explanation for any of it anyway.
Yeah. In what I witness politically, Jim, in what I witness in terms of organized religion, and what I witness in terms of the educational system, in terms of the world economy, and the military-industrial complex, I see everything on a total path of self-annihilation. And it's orchestrated by a handful of critters that want to be God, that do everything they can to separate us from God or the Creator, and at the same time try to act that role, try to play that part. And I see this whole project that we're talking about, and everything related to it for that matter, as just another attempt to be God. Somehow to try to surpass God, knowing full well God wouldn't create anything that operates without knowing the consequences. They know so little about the God that exists, just contemplating sitting in a lazy boy with a lamp and, you know, and a cup of tea and a newspaper, and contemplating what the creation might be like. There's absolutely no regard for safety or precautions. What do they expect to happen in the ground? Oh, well, if it causes a few more earthquakes, what's the big deal? We've been experiencing hundreds or thousands of them within the past month already. We've witnessed hundreds of thousands of deaths. What's the big deal? They're God. They can remove anybody from the planet that they so choose. I mean, this is absolute psychopathy. This is madness, total madness. I see no reason for this. That money could be spent feeding the people of the world, solving the world's problems, and certainly putting roofs over people's heads. Oh, no, not those that would be God. They couldn't allow that to happen.
Well, not only that, but you hit the nail on the head with the word money. Mm-hmm. I'll bet you dimes to donuts that if you could track the origin of those funds, they would all be coming out of the hip pocket of the population of world slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything is designed to milk and fleece you.
Yes. Yes, and I'm retreading old topics here, but I think it bears repeating, because what else do they do? And they lie to us about everything. So are we really hearing, you know, what we're hearing a BS story about what this is supposed to be? And 5 minutes of just considering what they're doing, I see nothing creative in it. I see destruction in it. The very, you know, we went through the period of nuclear fission, and then we went through the period of nuclear fusion. Now, what do you call this? This is somewhere in the middle where you have both going on at the same time?
Well, it's like nuclear annihilation.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. You know, I'm not the scientist, but I certainly understand scientific concepts. I know that, I mean, you mentioned the Van de Graaff generator, and I know that has been very useful in metaphysics in proving things that metaphysicians have been telling the general public about the nature of the human body, the nature of the aura. Planets have auras. Solar systems and galaxies have auras. In fact, the multiverse has an aura to it. It has a purpose. It has a structure. It has a meaning for its existence. And there's a way it functions. And we don't have to mess around with it for it to function properly. In fact, it's our messing around that presents the dangers, that presents all the problems.
Well, you hit the nail on the head earlier when you mentioned what those funds could be used for other than the super collider. You know, it's amazing to me how little we know about the real nature of life, the real nature of spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care whose religion you want to investigate. You know, the real crux of the issue is there is no such thing as theology, the way things currently stand. You show me any book, any study, any parchment, any verbal tradition, I don't care what, that actually talks about the nature of God, what is the purpose of our universe, what is the purpose of us as created and supposedly thinking beings, and how it all fits together, and I will immediately embrace that information. Why wouldn't it be much more beneficial to all of us concerned to actually figure out some way of helping human beings to know their creator on a one-to-one level, to understand more deeply and more succinctly what it is that we're here to do and what happens with our spiritual component after we shuffle off this body? The only people I know that have ever done research along those lines, and they've kept most of it secret, are the Russians, for God's sake. And those are the same people that everybody said were communists and atheists and, you know, heartless human beings, but they actually spent 20 years in just investigating the death mechanism and the reality of the spirit. At least they were doing that. You know, I would like to see a much more concentrated and scientific approach to the things that really matter. God already runs this universe. He designed it, and it's been working fine for countless eons. We don't have to tinker with it. But it would be nice to know who we are, what we are, and where the hell we're going.
Yes, I agree. And certainly my research and the pieces that I've written from my research have shown us who we are not, or who some of us are not. And the goal, as you said, is for us to know who we are. And that's a topic you and I have tackled many times on this show, Jim. And you know, until we do that, it's a topic that we're going to have to tackle again. You know, there's more to life and more to existence than just saying that something is so, but it's about being that. It's about becoming it and being it as a matter of meaningful experience. Everything is so artificial today. Everything. The news is artificial. It's propaganda. It means nothing other than to just throw something out there to muddy the waters, to muddy the waters of the thought. To muddy the physiological system, the functioning of life's physiological systems. All throughout nature, I'm not just speaking about man, but animals and nature itself, even the planet, the atmosphere. Everything is about muddying it, about contaminating it and polluting it with garbage. And all with the intent of driving us away, further and further away from the purpose we are here. You see, there must be something very powerful, Jim, in us knowing who we are and knowing how powerful we are. Because that would make what they're doing absolutely a nursery rhyme. Okay, it's a little Hostess cupcake for your birthday with a single candle on it. It has no significance what they're doing. Once we understand and begin to exercise, implement who we really are and act it out and become who we are, They have to rely on fear. They have to rely on lies. And all their mystical experimentation on meaningless science, destructive, if anything. You know, if it's got a militaristic end, it's something worth pursuing. Doesn't matter. Why would they build this in Switzerland, where they hide all the money and all, where they have all the secret bank accounts? Why would this be done there? You know, you have to look at these things in that way. Is it because if it is a problem, they're not finished taking over the United States completely yet, so can't have it happen over here. You know, they have other designs. Maybe they're going to target it once they figure out how to fine-tune it and target it on certain parts of the planet. They'll start shooting the beam, you know, outside the realm of this collider, the way they have the structure now. Or they'll figure a way to bounce it off of a satellite or another planet to bring it back here. I mean, the insanity. Most people don't care to look at that. Why? Because they don't really look at why they're alive. They've never asked themselves the question, why am I here? What am I here to do? Where am I going when I leave here? What is the purpose of life? What is the purpose of me? Who am I? They never ask those questions, do they?
Well, I can tell you that very, very few people do. And what's more, which is kind of disconcerting, actually, is the fact that if you bring that up in the course of normal conversation with an average individual, the looks and the treatment that you get are amazing. It's like, why are you talking about something like that? You know, I'm interested in who's going to be in the Super Bowl. I'm interested in tailgate parties. You know, I'm interested in this month's Playboy. Why are you bringing up that stuff? And that just goes to show you where we are and how powerful the illusion is and how complete it is in holding the attention of people who are immersed in materialism. But you know, the tragedy of it is that this is not real.
I know.
It's like a big stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of the scenery has been properly painted and all of the props and furniture look authentic, and everything is arranged in a certain way to augment the performance of the characters.
Oh, and we paid for the tickets, didn't we? We paid for the whole production.
Yeah. And we don't even realize we're actors.
Yeah, we pay for the whole thing, but we don't get to keep the gross receipts, do we?
Heavens no, that's how you build super colliders.
Well, you know, I don't mean to sound like an alarmist. I'm, you know, I see at every turn, there's no sense for doing something like this. It's as fraudulent as the International Space Station, or it's as fraudulent as NASA and the European Space Commission. These are just smoke and mirror parlor tricks as far as comparing what they do for the public, what's really going on, and what's really happening in the universe. You know, I mean, they really want us to be in awe of all the failed launches of rockets and space shuttles, and they want to promote these stories about being on this planet or looking at this planet, and they can't even show us the real way it looks. You know, they have to alter, they have to filter the light to make the sky look orange. Can't know that there's life up there, mind you. Or over time, all of a sudden it's okay to talk about ice, you know, on Mars. Well, is it orange ice because the rest of the planets, you know, or is it red ice? Because all the pictures you show us officially are nothing but orange and red. You know, So how do you identify the ice? You know, what about the bipedal animals walking around? What about the buildings and the tubes that go underground and come up above the ground and travel all around the planet? What about the masking of all the photographs that have been unmasked by others? You know, it's ridiculous what they do. The billions and trillions of dollars that they spend on what? Are they affecting the truth? Are they showing us the truth? Are they presenting the truth to us? And the rest of the universe is watching this. Watching how corrupt this system is at every level. Certainly at the level where they profess to be moving out to find other intelligence in the universe. You know, if they had intelligence, Jim, they would have found it already, wouldn't they? Sort of a tongue-in-cheek comment there.
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting thing is what you're hinging on right now or touching on was pretty well presented in that movie, the Day the Earth Stopped, or no, The Day the Earth Stood Still. The comment that was made by Michael Rennie to his contact here on Earth, that scientist guy, was that he said, we don't care what you do on your planet. He said, but when it comes to the point that your activities are having a negative effect on other worlds, you will be stopped. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if that's a truth. I mean, you know, all of this preparation and all this egotistical attitude and covert spending of money for taking over other worlds and all this other stuff that's going on, I don't think that that's going to be allowed to go very far. At least I hope it doesn't. I hope it isn't. Because they've made this place, which used to be a paradise, into an absolute mess. Why should they have the right to do it again elsewhere?
Why should they have the right to do it here, for that
matter?
Well,
they don't. But they violate that right. But the reason I brought it up is because hopefully there are other beings watching all of this that might say, you know what, we're drawing a line in the sand. You step across that, and we will swat you down.
Oh, I think that's been done a number of times. Actually, they haven't been swatted and stomped on, but certainly they've been spanked a few times.
Yeah, that's good. And you notice they keep that secret also.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, can't have the people know that there's life elsewhere. You know, all life that comes from space is because of weather balloons, crash dummies, and swamp gas. You ought to know that by now.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Always been the cover story. So if that's all there is out there, then why are they spending all this money? Why? What are they afraid of? What are they afraid of us knowing? That they spend all this money? That's quite obvious. How about their failures? How about all the lies? All the deception? All the corruption? We know about that too. I mean, what else is there? What else is there? I guess it's just the reptilians, isn't it? Come back to that same thing. That's the only thing. Oh, but they're not real. No, they're not real. The shapeshifters aren't real. Now, just make movies about them. Give the people something to do while we continue being corrupt. You see, and those individuals want to be God. Imagine that. With that kind of character, with those morals, they want to be God. I'm not saying God has to be moral. You know, God can turn on his promise in a heartbeat, couldn't he? And say, you know, I gave the universe free will, but I'm tired of it. I'm tired of what it does. And end it right there.
Well, you know, this whole Collider Project is not too not too tangential to the idea of the Tower of Babel. You know what happened there, at least in the biblical presentation.
I think they're trying to carbon copy it, to tell you the truth. Might be a slightly different design. Who knows? Maybe I haven't seen the blueprints. Maybe maybe they're going by ancient blueprints. You know?
Yeah, nothing would surprise me at this point.
Well, Jim,
but
we're out.
Thinking,
go ahead.
We're out of time again.
Yeah, we're out of time, but I want to give you a chance to make your concluding remarks here.
Well, the one thing I was thinking about, which I think is a good way to conclude this show, Don, you know, it annoys me that we really have come to believe, at least the majority of us, that our planet is the center of the universe and that all intelligent life, and maybe even all life, depending on what people choose to believe, is concentrated here. You know, if you go to any place, almost any place, even hot boiling volcanic springs or swamps or even ice, ice pools, anywhere on the planet where there's water, and you take a drop of that water and put it under a microscope, it's teeming with life. It's just teeming with it. And taking that one little drop of water and being impressed with all the variety of life that's squiggling around under your lens is sort of analogous to, you know, us viewing the planet Earth as a unique situation, just like that drop of water is. But what we lose sight of is that the rest of the pond, the rest of the ocean, the rest of the water source that we're taking that sample from is also teeming with life. It's a basic ingredient in the universe. It's no different than light or matter or gravity. We accept those things as being universal. What is the problem with accepting life as being universal? I guarantee you it is. It doesn't make any difference what we believe. What is what prevails. But the reason I use that analogy is because we have to start looking at the entire universe as a big pond that's teeming with life. And our planet is only one little drop under a microscope that happens to have 6 billion souls struggling for survival on it. That doesn't mean that their other worlds are devoid of life. It doesn't mean that at all. And I just thought that might be a good way to end the show and give people something to think about.
Well, certainly, and if I could conclude with just one remark, this collider, this Hadron Collider, that's intended to reproduce or bring about the seed of life, the God particle, while it's spinning, may be putting this planet and this end of the universe, if not the whole universe, into another cylindrical collider, more commonly known as a commode, or fundamentally as a toilet. Think about it. You've got a vortex there, too. Jim, I want to thank you. I got deep, didn't I? Now
well,
you were going to ask me how I was doing at the end of the show.
No, what?
You were going to ask me how I was doing at the end of the show.
Oh, well, okay. How are you doing now that we've covered all of this
in
the last hour or so?
I just explained it.
Oh. Gotcha.
You got
back
it.
To the big flush.
Yeah, yeah. They're after the Big Bang. That's the big flush, I think. Really? Well, Jim Murray, I want to thank you. Next week, we're going to have some important news to share with people out there. who are attempting to get new technologies, new ideas out on the marketplace and independently trying to do that. And we'll be talking about that for a portion of next week's show. I know you'll be excited about that as well as I and probably many people hearing about it.
Well, I'm happy to participate, as you know, and I look forward to our next show. And thank you for having me, Don.
Okay, you have a great weekend, and we're going to say goodnight to the listening audience. You have been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com, on blogtalkradio.com, and on Wind Talkers Radio Network. We want to thank those two networks for broadcasting the show. Special thanks to Seth Hendrick on the sound, also to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. Most of all, we'd like to thank you and the listening audience for tuning in. Join me next week, next Monday, when my special guest will be Dr. Andrew Ott. In the meantime, I wish everyone a great weekend and a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.